It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 82, for Friday, the 29th of June, 2012. On the show today, the gauntlet has never been more down or more heavily thrown in the tablets arena as Google unveils its own 7-inch slate that's half the price of an iPad. Meanwhile, Google's X-Lab develops a computer that effectively taught itself how to recognise the faces of cats. And is online activism as useful to a cause as getting out into the streets with banners and vocal cords? The Swedish Pirate Party's Rick Falkvinger says no. All that and more coming up as we canter through this week's paddock of Wired News. Nay, I'm Nate Langton, I'm the stallion of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, Hooves editor Duncan Gear. And of course, associate jockey Olivia underscore Solon. We have a horse theme this week. I have no idea.
Well, why do we have a horse theme?
I just wrote it in the intro and then decided to just continue ad lib.
I think it's good.
Okay, well, we've got a lot of big news this week, so we're going to have to crack on. We are going to save all the big Google I.O. announcements for the second half of the show because we have an awful lot there to talk about. Android 4.1 Jelly Bean has been shown off, the Nexus 7 tablet, obviously, which is being built by Asus, and of course the Nexus Q, which, well, it's a round object, and we'll explain exactly what that is a little later on. You won't want to miss that. But first, Ofcom has outlined its three strikes anti-piracy rules and costs live.
Yes, it has. I mean, we've been waiting for these for a while. These were first of all laid out in the Digital Economy Act, and it has finally issued its outlines this week, saying how exactly they're going to enforce this three strikes rule. And so what they're going to do is allow copyright owners to send infringement reports to ISPs. They have 10 days after the time that the copyright was infringed with which to do this, and then ISPs have to send letters to customers within 10 days.
I see. So just to jump in there, that is if they detect someone downloading a song or uploading a song illegally,
yes,
they have 10 days to go to the ISP and say, oi.
Yes, exactly. And if a single customer gets three letters in 12 months, they get added onto the rather ominous sounding copyright infringement list. And this is supposedly an anonymized document that allows copyright holders to kind of match the complaints they've made with anonymized subscribers. And the point is, if they see someone who's been particularly active, they can get a court order in order to force ISPs to reveal their real identities to kind of clamp down on the worst infringers.
So it's not so much three strikes and you're out as three strikes and you've got three strikes.
Three strikes and then we might get a court order on your ass. So it's not as bad as perhaps we could have been thinking, like Hadopi, where it was cutting families off from the internet.
But that was the French three strikes.
French three strikes rules. However, what I was quite surprised by was the sheer kind of volume. The rights holders get discounts if they report in bulk. So if you file 70,000 reports a month, it costs £17 per report, or 175,000 reports per month cost just £7.20. So they're going to be encouraged to send lots and lots of reports.
And that's what's kind of interesting to me. This has been built 100% for big media companies.
Yeah.
You know, little indie bands, you know, authors, people who self-publish, who own their own copyright, aren't going to be sending anywhere near those kinds of reports. And it makes it very, very expensive for those people to protect their copyrights.
Yeah, and the rights holders, but the one good thing is that the rights holders actually pay for most of this policing. All of Ofcom's costs are being covered by the rights holders, and 75% of the costs for ISPs. But
well, this is the right way around for it to be, because this means that this stops rights holders, or particularly aggressive rights holders, from just blanket requesting details left, right and centre. They're going to have to be more strategic in who they target, and targeting the ones that are, you know, potentially causing more damage than just a guy who downloads one song.
Yeah. People like the Open Rights Group are concerned that users have to pay £20 if they want to appeal any of these reports of piracy. So
but you get that cash back if you win, right?
You get that cash back if you win, but it could end up being a bit of a logistical, you know, nightmare, a lot of red tape. And
I think probably what a lot of people are hoping is that, you know, it's £20. That's probably going to deter quite a lot of people from bothering. They're just going to carry on, and then they won't do it, which is a real shame.
Mm. Now, this is going to be voted on, hasn't it, once more? Well, July,
this is the second draft of the policy. There's still, you know, another round of kind of consultation and stakeholders and stuff to all go through, with a view to presenting the code to Parliament later this year.
Right.
Though I think the European Commission has got to review it bit before that to see whether it works with their codes. So basically, yeah. Even if it is approved by the end of the year, it's going to be 2014 before any warning letters actually get sent out, if they get sent out. And then Strike 3 measures won't be on the table until 2015. So this is still a long way away.
We'll be on episode 300 reporting on the state of the first letters to be sent out, maybe.
Yeah.
It's been a stormy afternoon, Duncan, in the UK, but the US Army's latest weapon doesn't need thunderclouds, does it?
No, it doesn't. They've been using, they've been successfully testing a laser device that shoots out 50 billion watt bolts of lightning without any need for harvesting it from the skies.
Billion?
Billion, yes.
This is so awesome.
You could shoot down a whole lot of stuff with this.
Yes.
What is it for?
It's shooting people, really. It's called the laser-induced plasma channel, and it works by kind of pairing a really, really intense laser beam with an electromagnetic field strong enough to rip the electrons from the surrounding air molecules, producing a beam of plasma. And that plasma beam conducts electricity much, much, much better than air does. Air is actually a very good insulator. So what happens is, if you set up that laser so that the filament passes by a high voltage source, then the electrical energy from that source will travel down the filament and zap whatever is at the end of it.
This is bonkers.
It's bonkers.
What are they actually going to be using this on? Is this for sort of, you know, targeting aggressive rioters, or is this for like shooting, is it an anti-aircraft type thing?
It could be kind of all sorts of things. It will probably work quite well with vehicles, because obviously they conduct electricity, whereas humans conduct electricity a bit, but not as much as a vehicle does. But the idea is it's going to be used for striking specific objects without causing too much damage to the surrounding area. So rather than hurling a bomb into, you know, at a tank or something like that and blowing up everything around it, you can just zap the tank.
But is it easy to direct a lightning bolt very precisely? Because in my view, they seem to behave fairly erratically in terms of what they land on.
Well, it's basically the electricity will travel down this beam of plasma, and the beam of plasma travels in a very, very straight line because it's passing along where this laser beam.
Okay, so that will be what directs it.
So yes, that's what directs it, rather than a traditional lightning bolt, which has to pass through that very, very insulating air and try and find its way to the ground. But George Fisher, who's the physicist leading the project, said a wonderful thing. He said, "We never got tired of lightning bolts zapping our simulated targets." I can bet they were just sitting there just zapping things over and over and over again.
It's only really a matter of time before someone does, you know, ultra slow motion video of a 50 billion watts laser induced plasma cannon, you know, blowing up a melon.
Wasn't there a project recently where someone was trying to create an artificial lightning ray?
We reported on that,
25
actually.
Story kind of building.
There were like two giant Tesla coils, I think.
Oh, yes, it was the Tesla coils,
separated,
yeah.
I think, by...
That was more of an art project than a weapon, I think.
Yeah, but you could... that was the one where you could pay to have stuff blown up in
it.
Yes,
wasn't
correct.
It? You could pay like 100 euros or something.
It was a Kickstarter project,
that
I think.
Was it?
And if you paid a certain amount, you could put something in the strike field. But anyway, that's not this. The laser-induced plasma channel, or LIPC, is still in testing at the moment. It's not rugged enough for field use. And what the Army's going to do next is try and see if they can get this into some kind of Tesla tank or whatever.
Wow. Pretty intense stuff there, Duncan.
It's pretty shocking.
Yeah. Oh, for goodness sake. Let's talk about broadband. BT has revealed plans to test its lightning fast fibre to the premises broadband technology, which could give people speeds as high as 330 megabits per second internet in their houses.
That's fast.
That is incredibly fast.
What's kind of the highest speeds that people can kind of, people at home can achieve at the moment?
At the moment, I think the highest you can get commercially without going down some stupid route is Virgin Media. I think that's now up to 120. In fact, I think I have that. Because I pay for the 50 meg and I think they doubled it. Anyway, it's irrelevant. 120 meg is fastest. BT does one that I think goes up to 80 meg, not quite as fast as Virgin's. This one is different though, because this is actually going to bring the fiber rather than to the to like the cabinet that sits in the street and then copper for the rest of the journey into your house. This is going to be fiber straight into your home. So you are going from your computer to fiber to the internet, to the ISP. That is... and that is fast. But this isn't aimed for homes, really, I don't think. This is more aimed at businesses, I think.
It's going to cost small and medium-sized businesses.
Exactly, yeah. It's going to cost about £1,000 or more pounds just to install this thing. And people involved in the trial, which is what it's initially going to be, are going to have to assist BT with the cost of deployment. So it's not necessarily going to be something you want to go out and get. But they're going to start trials as early as next month, I think, July 2012, until early next year. I think Cornwall and Wickham, or High Wickham and Bristol, are going to get this first. And then parts of Watford, Cardiff, Basingstoke and Manchester in the early part of next year. So this is still a little way away from being a domestic product. But either way, very exciting stuff.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Well, Liv, moving on, you've been looking at a very interesting speech algorithm this week.
Yes, this is an algorithm that's been developed by a UK mathematician, and he kind of revealed it at TED, which is the amazing ideas inspirational conference that's been taking place this week. And it's an algorithm which identifies the unique characteristics in the voice of someone with Parkinson's disease. Around 70 to between 70 and 90% of Parkinson's sufferers get some form of vocal impairment, vocal tremors, breathiness, and reduced speech volume. And these are some of the earliest symptoms of the disease.
So the idea that this is something that could detect Parkinson's early?
Exactly. And so Max Little, the guy who's developed this algorithm, is now calling on members of the public to call up dedicated phone lines so that he can gather data from lots of different sufferers and non-sufferers' voices.
I see. And what the initiative is in the UK?
It's in the UK, it's in the US, Brazil, Mexico, Spain, Argentina and Canada. And it's called the Parkinson's Voice Initiative. There's a website which, if you search for that, you can find. And anyone can call in on these various different numbers anonymously and speak for around 3 minutes.
Is there anything in particular I have to speak about? I suppose it doesn't really matter. I find I'd be a little bit stumped calling up a phone and say, please speak for 3 minutes.
I think they have a few automated questions. But the point is that non-sufferers can call as well. They want to have this really strong database of I think they're looking for 10,000 calls, and they want to be able to distinguish between other voice changes that people might have when they've got a cold or when they've been heavily smoking.
We should play them the podcast down the phone.
We should do.
See if any of us have got Parkinson's.
God, that would be worrying. But the idea is that it could create a very, very cheap and accurate diagnosis tool for people before they show any of the more serious symptoms like actual bodily tremors. Mm. So if this is successful, and it seems to have quite a high level of accuracy in detecting these symptoms, it could be a really nice way of people finding out if they are likely to be suffering from Parkinson's without having to go to even a GP.
So Parkinson's Voice Initiative, a quick Google for that should show up the website, I think. Well, it wasn't the only algorithm-based story we had on the site this week. Computer scientists at Google's mysterious X Lab built a virtual neural network of 16,000 computer processors with a billion neuron-like connections within them and let it browse YouTube. And one of the first things that it did is actually what many web users might do, is it began to look for cats. This is according to a story by our Liat Clark, who was on the podcast a few weeks ago, one of our new writers. And she was writing this week that this sort of simulator, this brain simulator, was fed 10 million randomly selected YouTube video thumbnails over the course of 3 days. It was then given a list of 20,000 different items that were contained within these videos, one of which was cats, which is what the system then started to detect. And this was despite being fed absolutely no information as to what a cat was or what a cat's face looked like. The system achieved an 81.7% accuracy rate in detecting human faces, 76.7% in detecting human body parts, and most important of all, 74.8% accuracy when identifying cats. So this is a hell of an achievement.
Yeah. So this is all about kind of training image recognition software without having to tell it what it's looking for necessarily. It just recognizes similarity in lots of different places.
This is exactly what it is. The results basically of this experiment highlight that it is possible for a machine to learn to recognize faces without being told whether an image contains a face at all. It can learn what a face is and then learn to identify what a face is. You know, cats were one of the objects in these YouTube videos that was in this list of 20,000 objects, and it was able to identify that, you know, this video all contain this object, which was a
this
cat.
Furry, this furry, cute, lovable object.
So incredibly useful to create like a search, image video search.
Well, that's precisely it. This is obviously something that really is a problem for Google and any video sharing site, really, is that it very largely relies on metadata and to a certain extent audio transcriptions if it's capable. But really, when you're talking about on-screen objects, if there's no sound and no metadata, how the hell is any search engine supposed to be able to identify, well, there is a cat here and two humans, versus there's a, you know, a box of knives, I don't know. The first time I thought this, I kind of thought that it wasn't that big a deal because your phone can recognize a face. But the difference there is that when a phone camera is sort of identifying a face so it can focus on the faces instead of the background, it's been programmed that this is what a face is. Yeah. Here are the trademarks that you get with
and
a face.
Feed it with 10,000 faces before it even works as a facial recognition.
Exactly. Thing. Whereas what this system is able to do is actually, you know, learn what a face is to begin with and say, well, I've found that this is a thing and here it is in these other, you know, I don't know, 10,000 video thumbnails. It's the same one. And it has, you know, very high accuracy in doing that.
Jeff Dean, who's one of the Google fellows who led the study, said a wonderful thing to the New York Times. He said, "We never told it during the training, this is a cat. It basically invented the concept of a cat on its own."
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. Andrew Ng, actually, who's a computer scientist at Stanford University, who was involved in the project, elaborated a little bit as well, saying that the idea is that instead of having teams of researchers trying to find out how to find edges, you instead throw a ton of data at an algorithm and have the software automatically learn from the data. So it's, you know, it's pretty amazing stuff. Obviously of huge interest to Google as the web gets far more focused on video and, well, not less so on text, but you know what I mean?
It reminds me a little bit of something that BBC R&D is working on to help tag all of its archived content. They wanted to find a way of being able to automatically screen all their archive footage to be able to work out what was in there without someone having to sit and watch millions and millions of hours. So I don't think it was probably as sophisticated as this, but it was certainly a step in the right direction.
Well, this is a long way off being deployed, but you know, it is at least the first of its kind, we think, to successfully identify objects without any kind of hints or additional info. So pretty exciting stuff. Anyway, from little cats, I suppose, to massive cats, Liv. Turf wars, specifically, betwixt these large quadrupeds.
I'm sort of talking about big cats. This is a mathematical model that's been used for 80 years to determine the hunting range of wild animals, such as lions, those big quadrupeds, but also chimpanzees and bees. And these mathematical models have been used to help map gang territories in LA. The actual kind of equations in question are the Lotka-Volterra equations, which were designed in the 1930s to help model the way that different populations of species compete with each other for common resources.
And when you talk about gangs in Los Angeles, we're talking about gangs of humans.
Human gangs,
rogues,
yes.
Not lions.
Yes. A team at UCLA, a team of social scientists, used the same model to assess where the most dangerous place in an LA neighborhood was, which had 13 different gangs. And they found there were a lot of similarities between the way that the animals squabble over the territories and gangs do. And so the idea is that they want to map gang territories in a better way to help police know how to allocate their resources.
Interesting. Once again, learning from the animals.
Exactly. We ain't nothing but mammals. I was going to say we are nothing but mammals, but that isn't really the lyric, is it?
So what we could do basically is set up a kind of model of London.
Yeah.
And then put beehives in the places where, you know, towers are.
Yes.
And then unleash the bees and we'd kind of work out where there's going to be violence.
Well, you don't really even need to do that. What the team here did was they...
Yes, I want to unleash
the bees. Okay, well, you can do that. But what the team here did was they found the kind of home base of the gang, which might be a shop or where they both generally like loiter the most. That's the equivalent of the beehive.
Yep.
And then they used that. And what they found was that generally territories are divided, gang territories are divided almost very equally between the home bases of two different gangs.
I just want to unleash your bees.
Okay. Or the home bases of East London, perhaps.
Well, perhaps. But that might sound quite intuitive, but police have traditionally mapped gang territories by looking at stuff like graffiti with gang signs, and they've always delineated it along kind of clear geographical landmarks like roads and kind of obvious ways you divide it. But actually the study found that the boundaries that they use don't neatly follow streets. They're much they kind of go through gardens and alleyways, and they found that their model very accurately predicted where crimes would be carried out based on this equation.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we we come back, we're going to find out all the information you need to know about everything Google announced at its I.O. conference this week.
Wired's second annual summit is coming. Following a sellout debut in 2011, Wired 2012 will feature an incredible lineup of speakers and thought-provoking talks over 2 days in London. The first names have already been announced, so find out more at wiredevent.co.uk.
Google I.O. This is Google's conference, Duncan. You've been following this extremely closely this week.
Extremely, with a microscope.
You have. I saw you. It was viciously... don't know what it was.
What's magnifying.
Go on.
Enlightening.
Yeah. What's been happening? Google has announced a tablet in conjunction with Asus, or Asus, as I tend to call them, and probably will end up calling them in this podcast. They've announced the latest version of Android, which is codenamed Jelly Bean, and they have announced this weird, like, ball-like thing called the Nexus Q, which is a media streamer, and then they threw a man out of a plane.
Okay, well, it wasn't a plane, it was a Zeppelin, but let's come back to this.
Right.
Yeah, well, if we're going to be a news organisation, we need to be accurate, don't we, old sausage? Let's start at the top with Google Android 4.1 Jelly Bean, so-called because they name each version after a different type of food in the alphabet, for anyone wondering. What is the most interesting thing about Android, Duncan? Is it going to get me away from my iPhone?
To be honest, it probably won't get you away from your iPhone, but it will excite a lot of people who are on the iPhone, on the Android platform already. It is considerably faster than the existing version of, or the previous version of Android, Ice Cream Sandwich. Google has been running this project called Project Butter. And Project Butter is all about going through the UI, going through the code, and nipping out little bits of code here and there that are slowing things down. And as a result, Jelly Bean is a whole lot faster to use. There's almost no perceptible lag on the devices that we've played.
Oh, I see. Smooth as butter.
Yes, I think that was the thing.
Okay, good start. What else?
There's also offline maps and offline voice recognition, which is incredible to my mind. Offline maps is obviously it explains itself. You can download directions and mapping coordinates and everything of a city. But much, much more exciting is offline voice recognition. If you're in airplane mode on your iPhone and you talk to Siri, nothing happens. But on the new version of Android, if you talk to the operating system, it will still be able to decode exactly what you're saying.
To be honest, though, you can have airplane off and a full Wi-Fi signal and talk to Siri and little happens. But but I know what you mean. Let's actually just move quickly into the second bit because it relates quite closely, which is Google announced the Nexus 7, which
yes.
is a 7-inch tablet running Jelly Bean,
yep.
which you got to play with and test out just this morning, in fact.
Yes. Today when you're probably listening to this podcast, but it's a really interesting device. It's got a 7-inch screen, which is obviously quite a bit smaller than the iPad screen, but it's not really aimed at competing with the iPad at all. That's what I found most interesting. It's instead aiming directly at Amazon and the Kindle Fire,
which is a 7-inch, but basically a posh ebook reader in the US that hopefully will come out this in the UK later this year.
Yes.
But that explains the price, because that sort of took a lot of people by surprise, at least those who hadn't seen any of the leaks and rumours.
Yeah, it's focused very much on media consumption in the same way the Kindle Fire is. But in every other way, in every hardware capacity, it exceeds the Kindle Fire.
Mm.
And most importantly, it's cheaper than the Kindle Fire.
Yeah, £159.
£159, which, you know, the iPad 2, which came out, best part of a year and a half ago now,
yeah.
Is more than twice as expensive as this is going to be when it arrives.
But you're saying that it's not about competing with the iPad, because they are still really quite different devices.
But there are a lot of people who aren't buying iPads because they think they can't afford it or something like that, and there's going to be a huge market for a cheap, effective tablet that you can just use for media consumption and not, you know, go all out with and kind of play synthesizers on or whatever, but just something that you can read the internet with, you can check your email. It's a really, really nice device for doing that.
Okay, and you speak from personal experience. Okay, and then the other thing is this thing called the Nexus Q, which
is weird.
As far as I can tell from my knowledge of this thing, it's basically a perfectly spherical alternative to a Apple TV or a Sonos.
Kind of, yeah. It's a media streamer. So what it does is it finds your media up in the cloud, your music or your films or whatever, and it pulls it down and it will send it to whatever it's plugged into.
Specifically, though, films and stuff that you've bought through Google Play, I believe.
Through Google's Play Store. I mean, I'd be very, very surprised. We haven't played with this in person yet, but I'd be very surprised if it doesn't work with a network drive or something like that and let you access your content from elsewhere. But what's kind of interesting is the way they've gone about it. They've gone for a very hacker-friendly approach to building this. You'll be able to sort of tinker with it and stuff. The whole top of the device device acts like a massive volume knob, and it's got an amplifier inside, so you can just plug speakers into it and then pump music out of it.
And they've made this themselves as well, haven't
they? Yes, yeah, that's the other really interesting thing. This is the first time that Google has actually built hardware that's going to sell to people itself. All the Google devices in the past have been built with hardware partners. This is the first time they've made something themselves, and they've made it entirely in America.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was another little interesting thing that came out of this. It's all built in the States. I have to say, I think the Nexus 7 sounds great. I think if anyone wondering, do they buy that as an alternative to the iPad, I think it's really just comes down to price, really.
Yeah, it's definitely worth considering. And it also kind of depends on how invested you are in the rest of the Google kind of ecosystem compared to how invested you are in Apple's ecosystem.
Yeah, but the music streamer, I have to say, I don't expect that to do particularly well.
It's weird. It feels like a kind of experiment that they've chucked up on stage. It will be disappointing if this happens, but I kind of feel like we might never hear anything about it ever again.
I think so. It costs $300 in America, and based on the same prices they're using,
which is twice the amount of their tablet that they launched at the same event.
Well, and the Apple TV is only £99. That streams YouTube. That streams music from devices and stuff. So we'll see. We've got a whole bunch of hands-ons and news and stuff on the website. If you search for, well, I guess Android and Nexus 7, things like that.
Yeah, and if you've got any thoughts yourself on these things, if you've kind of read our stuff, if you want to just ask us any questions about it, because we've played with it, then email us podcast@wired.co.uk.
Actually, probably better, Facebook page, facebook.com/wiredUK.
Yeah, you can also ask us there.
Yeah. One last thing we want to get to before we wrap up the show today. Liv, a really interesting piece on the website we've got this week from the Swedish Pirate Party concerning activism.
Yeah, I went to the Guardian Activate conference this week, and one of the speakers there was the founder of the Swedish Pirate Party, Rick Falkvinger.
Yeah, he's kind of the founder of the pirate movement internationally, because obviously the Swedish Pirate Party was the first one in the entire world.
Yeah, and this is obviously a political movement that's very focused on kind of internet web rights and being a living in a connected world, which is very unlike most other political parties. And he argued that online activism is not enough. It's really important to get people on the streets in order to have any real world political influence. And one of the interesting things he flagged up was that in the early days of the Pirate Party, they made a real effort to make sure members wore clothing with the Pirate Party logo on, because they wanted to make them visible to others.
Show them that these are actually real people and not just guys on the internet.
And not just to other people who support the Pirate Party, but to other people who are supporting other political parties, to kind of validate it as a party. And he said that you need to bring people out into the street so that others can see people that they identify with, or else they're not going to take a new movement to heart.
But this is one of the things that has been sort of addressed with the sort of notion of slacktivism, you know, stuff like, you know, to show your support for something going on online, something like, you know, changing your Twitter logo to a black square when they had, was it the Australian New Zealand blackout, I think, or something like that. These twibbons where you can put a little ribbon around your Twitter icon. That presents a very similar visibility, and on a global scale, potentially, you know, particularly depending on how many followers you have, that en masse people recognize and start to search about.
But it's very easy to dismiss that as a load of guys on the internet who haven't got anything better to do. Whereas if you sort of see people in public who've taken the time to, stand up for what they believe in, then that's a much, much more powerful message. I think that's what Falkvinger is saying here.
Yeah, I guess it is easier to add a twibbon or to, you know, tweet some support as opposed to even sending a letter or lobbying your politicians. But I don't think it should be dismissed altogether. You know, it absolutely raises awareness among people who might not necessarily be politically motivated already.
Yeah.
But one of the other interesting speakers, a guy called Jonathan Moore from an organisation called Government in the Lab, actually argued that even when there is activism in the street, such as the Occupy movement, which had more than 2,000 protests around the world, it doesn't always achieve very much. I mean, what has been achieved from the Occupy movement? And he said that was down to a lack of centralised leadership. So sometimes these distributed forms of activism can't actually go the final furlong because they don't have someone kind of creating clear objectives that could perhaps, you know, be then executed following the support.
But I think that's an organisational problem rather than a practical problem with raising awareness necessarily. I mean, I can think...
It's more about turning the awareness into action. And I think that's something that obviously the Pirate Party has. It has it does have an organisational structure.
And they've done very, very well in Sweden. Yeah. They've got several MPs, haven't they?
They've got MPs or MEPs? They've got two MEPs. MEPs in the European Parliament, and they got 225,000 votes in Sweden, which is a very large number in a very small population.
But this is, I mean, I've always questioned, you know, I find this sort of this notion of armchair, you know, activism, this slacktivism, to be sort of, it's a two-sided coin, die, whatever the expression is.
It wouldn't be a two-sided die.
Well, you know what
double-edged
I mean.
Sword.
A double-edged sword, in a sense, because you can have somebody, you know, who feels, well, I'm contributing, I'm really helping, because you've changed your Twitter logo, you know, with your 17 followers and the fact that you only tweet at celebrities. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean you're doing anything, but that person might then sit around at home. I mean, it's, you know, it reminds me a little bit of, you know, homeopathy in a certain sense. The problem isn't necessarily that someone who is sad suddenly feels better because they've had a homeopathic remedy and it's placebo or whatever, but it might stop them going to the doctor next time when they've got something very, very seriously wrong with them. And I wonder if that's an analogy or
well, it's like if social media metrics were used to measure the success of the last UK election, the Liberal Democrats would have probably won, but unfortunately the support that was there online didn't translate to votes at the polling station.
But sometimes that does happen. I mean, we've seen, you know, things like ACTA has been demolished by an entirely leaderless movement. You know, there's been no leader whatsoever. So Jonathan Moore, you know, his theory that they need a leader.
But that's people.
That
no, but there
out.
Have been people like the Open Rights Group and EFF who have really driven the agenda with ACTA. And I think, and
I don't know if I could call that centralized leadership, though.
But I don't think it's centralized, but people are really, organizations are kind of driving the agenda, informing people, and actually lobbying. They were actually lobbying politicians.
I'm not sure that ACTA is a great example, though, because, I mean, you're talking about something that you know, threatens the very nature that people use to complain about it, in a sense. You know, it's about the internet, so you're inherently going to be more interested in it. It's like whenever we publish a story about Twitter and tweet about it, you know, people really want to read it because they're customers of this thing we're talking about, so it's immediately relevant.
But I mean, you could say that the Occupy movement, you know, all this stuff that they were talking about was directly relevant to everyone's lives, and as we saw, it didn't achieve anything.
Well, maybe that's a question for the leadership. Many factors at play here. I mean, I'm curious to know what people think about the notion of slacktivism, whether, you know, this armchair protesting actually does have a use, or whether it is just better to get out in the streets with a banner and a loud voice. Let us know what you think. Facebook.com/WideUK. Obviously, we've got a story on the website if you search online activism to find out, you know, a great deal more, I would say, Duncan, wouldn't you?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. We're going to wrap up the show. Liv, I'm going to go to you. How do people get in touch with their feedback? Do they want to protest from their armchair, their comfortable armchair?
Sing us a protest song.
You can call us on a landline or a mobile. We're on 0208 123 0468. Or if you're on Skype, just call Wired UK Podcast and that will be for free.
We don't always listen to them. We don't always play them, but we do always listen to them.
We do. Sometimes it's just heavy breathing, which has unnerved us slightly. But you can also follow us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK, and we have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/WiredUK.
As ever, you can also email us podcast@wired.co.uk. We love getting your emails.
We do, particularly me. I love it. I sit there and just grin for like 7 minutes every time an email comes in.
You've got a little stopwatch.
I have, yeah. And on that note, see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Ahoy, hoy, Nate Langston here. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. Join me.
Ahoy, hoy is fine, but nay isn't.
Nay was way better.